Young men, young women, and you brethren who have assembled. It certainly is gratifying to me to get to come in your midst and to have somewhat to say for the next few days regarding matters that I trust may be of interest and profit to all of you who hear. I've been a little bit slow to catch on to what this is all about. And possibly I haven't fully realized yet. I may be somewhat like the Englishman who came to this country, stepped off the ship at New York, and took a taxi up to the hotel. On the way up, he got to talking with a taxi driver, who in turn asked him if he enjoyed a riddle. Always of the finest kind. I just revel and delight in them. Well, I said, I have one to tell you. A child was born to my mother. It wasn't my sister. Wasn't my brother. Who was it? Well, the Englishman sat there and studied for a while and said, will you repeat that? Said, yes. A child was born to my mother. Wasn't my sister. Wasn't my brother. Who was it? Said, well, I just don't know. You'll have to tell me. Why, the taxi driver said, why, I'm the boy, and I'm the fellow that was born to my mother. And then he said, well, that's a good one. And I'm just joy and rejoiced to hear it. I'll tell it to my brethren when I get back home. He toured this country for some time and went back. And, of course, they gave them a fine reception. And after telling about the wondrous things of America, he said, brethren, while I was over there, I heard one of the finest riddles of all. I want to tell it to you. They said, out with it. Well, he said, the child was born to my mother. It wasn't my sister, it wasn't my brother. Who was it? And they dropped their chins and thought for us, said, well, sir, we just simply can't fathom the depth of it. You'll have to tell us. Why, sir, it's a taxi driver in New York City. There's one thing that I want to settle right now. I went to Fifth and Highland Church yesterday morning, and the first man I saw asked me if it was a fact that I was 80 years old. I don't know why he had to butt into a thing of that kind or not. I told him that I was going on 90. And yet, I'm comparatively young. I heard of an old man, 90 years old, sitting out on the back steps of his home, crying as if his heart would break. Somebody came along and asked him, what on earth's the trouble? Says, my daddy whipped me. And he said, well, what for? Said, because I threw a rock at Grandpa. So, I'm just beginning in the full realization of life's affairs. It was said that I had come out here to lecture and talk, rather, to young preachers. There are so many things that they need to know that time would fail to tell, all along that line. There isn't anybody living, young men, that can tell you how to preach. They can help you to gain information and to learn things, but after all, you've got to gather up the material and arrange them, unless you're a copyist, after your own fashion. And just brief about it, I think you should select some good speaker. Doesn't have to be a preacher by any means. And observe carefully his manner, his way of handling his voice, his articulation, and the distinctiveness thereof, and pattern after him. I've often been asked, who are my ideals of speakers? And I think I can truly say, William Jennings Bryan and Edward Ward Carmack of Tennessee. There's not been born upon the earth from that time till this. They're superiors. You could hear them in all the phase of their address, no matter where you sat in the auditorium. And yet they were not squalling as if they wanted to burst their vocal organs, nor were they down mumbling like a bumblebee, it is said, in a barrel. But like Peter declared, lift up your voice and let people understand what you're talking about. Attention is gained most of all by the ability of your audience to hear what you have to say. And there's no excuse on God's earth for any brother leading in prayer to mumble so that you can't hear him. We're supposed to say amen when the fellow gets through. But I've bowed a number of times, never did know when the fellow come in or when he ended, except I saw the others getting up, and I just supposed about time to rise. But whether I could say amen to it or not, I do not know. Now, the best things that you'll ever learn, or some of them at least, have never been written in a book. But you gain them by contact and observation and study of things in general. And the young man that starts out to make a preacher and centers all of his thoughts simply upon the Bible and that alone, he'll not get anywhere along the lines of that kind. You want to mix and mingle with the world in general, with the brethren, and with the sister-in, in quotations, all along the line. You need to know things that are interesting to them, and from which you will find that you draw some of your finest illustrations, and that of the simplest kind. And those are they that the world appreciates more than anything else. Why, of course, you boys should know something about farming, the interests that attach to the same. You should know something about livestock and be able to talk with the farmers and their raisers of just such, wherever you find them, and not disgust them by talking about the church all the time and the Bible evermore, because there are not many, some of them are not interested in matters of that kind. It's surprising sometimes just to see how little folks know about the common things of earth. I've handled horses for 40 years or more. In fact, I can't remember hardly when I have known one until right recently. I've had people ask me so many things about it. A young preacher, graduate of one of our schools, was over at my barn one day, and I told him that I had a nice mare here made of cotton that's known throughout the United States, and on which I have possibly won more than 100 blue ribbons with silverware galore. And then I said, I have a nice filly back here. And he said, Brother Arnold, just what is a filly, by the way? I said, well, if you don't know, I don't have time to tell you. And the idea of a young preacher going out among the brethren, visiting their homes and farms, and not knowing, by the way, what a filly is. Why, there's some that do not even know what a myth is. That's a female moth, if you boys want to know. So, get acquainted with things of that kind. Why, you ought to be able to talk with the dear sisters about their chickens and the different kinds of them, as the Plymouth Rock and the Wyandotte, the Cornish Game, the Burke Orpington, and various others of that type. And then get over to the husband and talk about the hogs, the bacon type and the lard type. The first, the Berkshire, the Tamworth, and the Hampshire is a mixture. And then the Poland China, the Duroc, and the Suffolk, and the OIC, and so on. And therefore, let the world know that you know something other than simply one track mind down the line, however good that may be. And when you come to the observation of their cattle, why, know the difference between a beef type and a dairy type, and be able to name a lot of them. And when you get into the milk type, why, talk about the Jerseys and the Guernseys, and the various kind, the brown Swiss, by the way, and the Holstein. And then get off on the beef type, by the way, as the Shorthorn, the Angus, and the White Face, and the Santa Gertrudis. How many of you know what kind of an animal that is? Well, several of you. It started here in Texas, down at the King Ranch, and be able to talk about those things. And then if you get with brethren that like horses, and lots of them do, and handle them, why, know something about it, the difference between a horse and a mule, and where to put the saddle, and which end of it goes in front, and so on. Why, if you get to somebody that talks about things of that kind, he'll say, I deal with the heavyweight horses. That means with the Belgian coach, the Norman horse, or the Clydesdale, or the English Suffolk. And then if you get the light harness horses, or light horses, why, you have the thoroughbreds, the standardbred, the American saddle horse, the Tennessee walking horse, the Shetland pony, and likewise the Hackney. And by the way, right down here at Withers, Texas, are some of the finest Shetland ponies that I know of anywhere. About a month ago, I went to the Dixie Jubilee Horse Show at Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and this man had his ponies from Winters, Texas, and there displayed them in various relations to the delight and pleasure of the entire audience. Now, I take it that you know what a thoroughbred horse is. That's a running horse. And what you have out here, the quarter horse, he wanted to run a mile, but he couldn't run over a quarter very fast, and he developed, therefore, into a short speed, a short length, rather, of high speed, the quarter horse. Then the standard bred, like old Dan Pax, George Gano, and various others of that type. To me now, all of that is interesting. I look to know and talk about the world's record in pacing, which was held by two horses, Billy Direct of Tennessee and Dan Patch of Minnesota. And then the trotting outstanding horses, Lou Dillon, Nancy Hanks, and then the present one, the Greyhound, that trotted a mile in 1:55. And then when I talk about the saddle horse, that means the five gated horses that are in the shows today. There are five gates, walk and trot and slow gait, rack and canter. And then back to the Tennessee walking horse, the flat foot walk and the running walk and the canter. And thus we go on our way. Why, certainly, boys, we should become acquainted with things of that kind. And not like a city bred candidate for governor some 2 years ago in Tennessee wanted to be familiar with things of that sort and walked out with a farmer and looked at his hogs. And he saw one of a terrible size, weighed 500 or 600 pounds. And he said, just how many hams now could you get out of a hog of that size? Well, he spilt the beans and tried to be wise when he proved otherwise, along lines of that kind. And so I suggest to you, first of all, get a general knowledge of things with which we have to do, and be able to talk with people along their line, letting them do the leading, and you be the querist, and ask them about varied matters. And that'll hold, by the way, in all kind of games and exercises that people have today. Then in addition to that, you need to know historic matters. Way back with ancient history, then medieval and modern. And especially, you ought to know the history of this our land, the greatest upon which the sun has ever shined. And the history of America ought to be studied more and more in order that we might have a keener appreciation of this splendid country in which it allows us to live. Now, you might pick up an American history, and unless you have studied and had someone to direct you, maybe, it's the most uninteresting thing at all. Why, you couldn't just close your eyes and let fall open and commence there and read with any intelligence whatsoever. But our American history is divided into periods. They're five in number. And here they are. First, there's the what we call the aboriginal period. They appeared from the beginning down to some special event. Well, that begins with time unknown and goes down to the discovery of America, 1492. Now, within that time, well, I just studied the characters that were prominent during that period. Of course, of them, we know but little. But there are three that are spoken of: the Northmen, the Mound Builders, and the Indians. There are evidences of their existence all over our land, and while the information is quite meager, but learn all you can regarding it. And when some question comes up about matters of that kind, why, don't turn to Washington's administration and search in vain, nor over to that of Abraham Lincoln, but get back of 1492 and study those three characters. Well, the second period is introduced with the discovery of America, 1492, and goes down to the settlement of Jamestown, Virginia, 1607, and just fix those dates from the discovery under the settlement, from 1492 to 1607. And within that, what do you have? Well, you have the explorations of five nations, namely Spain and France and Portugal and England and Holland. All five sending out their ships and their explorers, prompted each of them by a different motive. Now, just briefly, the purpose of the Spaniards was to establish an effete government, an old-form government on this new world. That of the French, to plant the Jesuit or the Catholic religion. And that of the Dutch, by the way, was to gain wealth, as well as the Portuguese. And that of the English was to find an asylum, a place of freedom from the oppressions that were bearing down upon them. Hence, you come to the third period, that of settlement. And that begins with Jamestown and goes on down through settlement and development till 1775. And in that period, you have the 13 original colonies that planted themselves along the middle Atlantic and there set about to establish a government wherein freedom could prevail. And after the last one was settled, Georgia, in 1732, they began their development and were handicapped. The English country wouldn't allow them any privilege whatsoever, but imposed upon them heavy taxes. And the cry began, taxation without representation. Well, that continued on for a spell until finally, in old Mecklenburg County, North Carolina, 1775, the people of that county drew up a Declaration of Independence. That was the beginning of just such a document. Then the next year, that immortal document written by the sage of Monticelli, Thomas Jefferson, was drafted, greater than which there had never been. But after it was adopted by a sufficient number, England challenged their right to be free and independent. And hence, a new period begins, the Revolutionary Period, commencing 1775 and going on down to 1789, the inauguration of the National Period. Now, during that time, there was the bloody Revolutionary War, all the way, by the way, from Bunker Hill unto Yorktown, when old Cornwallis handed the sword to General Washington and thus recognized a new nation born upon the earth. Then there was the signing of the treaty, 1783, but they were in a wonderful condition, unsatisfactory. They were living under what is called the Articles of Confederation, which were lacking, especially in that there was no provision for an executive department. They could make any law they wanted and decide upon it, but when it came to enforcing it, there they were lacking. So, a convention was called in Philadelphia, and after an effort to revise the Articles of Confederation,
It seemed such a mess, and that's the right word, that it was finally suggested, let's cast it aside, and with a clean sheet, let's draft a constitution for these United States of America. And then in historic affairs, the greatest document ever penned was drawn up, acknowledged, and signed. While the preamble to that, stating the purpose of it, ought to be known, I don't know whether I can say it or not, but it's something like this. We, the people of the United States of America, in order to form a more perfect union, to establish justice, to provide for the common defense, and to promote the general welfare, do hereby ordain and establish this Constitution as that which guarantees life and liberty in the pursuit of happiness to all of our people. And thus we started out upon a different period altogether that provided for an executive. And of course all eyes turned to General Washington, and without a dissenting voice he was elected and inaugurated. 1789, on April the 30th, they didn't have Fords and other automobiles. They didn't have fast trains. They had no airplanes, and hence he was delayed in getting to the Capitol from March the 4th till April 30th, at which time the new government was begun, and that's the one under which we now live. Now get it. If I wanted to learn something about the struggle of the colonial people, just where shall I turn? Shall I go back to the aboriginal period? No. Well, to the period of exploration? No. But I go to that period wherein they are prominent and where the story is there told. And just so about all the rest of them. Now, beginning with our national period, Washington administration, a new order set forth. Washington was president and John Adams was vice president. The Constitution provided for a cabinet, and Washington selected four men, namely Thomas Jefferson as Secretary of Foreign Affairs or Secretary of State, Alexander Hamilton as Secretary of the Treasury, Henry Knox as Secretary of War, and Edmund Randolph as Attorney General. And thus the ship of state was launched to wave its way, pave its way, and to carve its name indelibly upon the historic pages of the past. Very soon, however, after Washington's inauguration, if you will recall and be able to discuss it, there arose a conflict. Jefferson and Hamilton, greater than whom they have never been, differed regarding policies and matters of carrying on the government. Hamilton wanted to have a strong central government, with the states yielding their powers under the federal control. Jefferson, on the other hand, believed in states' rights and granting to the federal government only just that which was absolutely necessary for its carrying on. Hence, the two parties began to spring up. Hamilton, the father of the Federalist Party, Jefferson, the father of the Anti-Federalist, or those have come down to us as the Republican and the Democratic Party. One of the first things that Mr. Hamilton suggested was that this new nation, just born upon the earth, assume all debts of each of the colonies and likewise the debt incurred by the Revolutionary War. That was a wonderful undertaking, but he was a genius, and it was said of him that he struck the rock of internal resources, and abundant streams of revenue gushed forth. He had but to touch the red corks of public credit, and it sprang up on his feet. And thus the ship of state was launched with the idea, pay as you go. And had that been perpetuated, we would not today be under a debt of more than $250 billion, which possibly will never be paid. Now I just wonder, do you young men starting out as candidates for preachers, some of whom may get defeated, by the way, but Do you know something about the history of our government as it was launched an independent order? Do you know the presidents and some of the leading events characteristic of each administration? I think that I wouldn't be as I should unless I could discuss the presidents of the United States, because the history of any country is but the history of its leading men. If you know the story of the men that have made prominent affairs, you know historic matters pretty well. Why the presidents are, I'll start them, and if you want to go ahead with them, all right. Washington and Adams and Jefferson and Madison and Monroe, Adams and Jackson, number 7 from Tennessee. And then if you want Van Buren, Harrison, Tyler, Polk and Taylor, Fillmore, Pierce, Buchanan and Lincoln, all right. And you pass over the 11th president, Polk, another Tennessean, may I say. I wonder if I'm going to come to Texas somewhere down the line. Well, after Lincoln, there was Johnson and Grant and Hayes and Garfield and Arthur and Cleveland, Harrison, Cleveland again. The only president ever selected and running twice and being elected after an interim. And after Cleveland, then McKinley, by the way, and then Roosevelt. And then Taft and Wilson and Harding and Coolidge and Hoover. And Roosevelt. Then that other fellow that wiggled around up in the presidential chair, Truman. And finally, General Eisenhower. Now, when you get to where you understand some of those matters, you can draw upon your knowledge of the same for some of the finest illustrations that are not only illustrate, but teach as well some of the matters with which this country of ours has had to do. And after you've studied all of them and noted the prosperity of the country under the different ones, wait, by the way, until you're through with that and then decide, I want to be a Democrat or a Republican. But as a rule, we first take our stand and become wonderfully excited about it. I'm this or that, and if someone would ask you why, I do not know. And that's true everywhere. Now get those 5 periods of American history. The Aboriginal period, from the beginning to 1492. The period of discovery and exploration, from 1492 to 1607. The next, the period of settlement and development, from 1607 to 1775. And then, the great revolutionary period, from 75 to 89. And remember some of the battles that are therein fought. And then our national period, from 1789 until 1954. While the ignorance of the Bible is lamentable, and likewise of the historic matter with which we've had to do, on the part of so many, even preachers, by the way. Therefore, I suggest you learn the common things of earth, that which people understand and talk about, and preach in the simplest form possible. Why, I've had it said of me and heard someone say, Brother Hartman, I like you because you're so simple. Of course, that can have 2 different meanings. And I ascribe to it the one that I want to. People can understand things along that line. And if they ask you something about the various relations of farm life or anything else, why, tell them about it. Way back yonder, I was superintendent of public education of my county for 12 years. At that time, it is customary to have an institute of teachers for, say, 2 weeks, at the end of which we had the examination preparatory to the issuing of certificates to teach. And, of course, questions were made out on all phases, and those that made a reasonable grade were passed, first grade certificate, second or third. In one of the questions in the subject of agriculture among the Negro teachers, while he was asked to name four kinds of sheep. Well, he wasn't reared in the sheep country and didn't know much about them. And that stopped him right on the spot. Four kinds of sheep. But he was somewhat of a genius. After studying for a little bit, why, he wrote down an answer. And here's what he put. He said, well, there are black sheep, white sheep, Mary's little lamb, and the hydraulic ram. And then she passed his grade. Get by, if you possibly can. Now, all that is but introductory. And Brother Fred, how long am I supposed to talk?
About 45 minutes.
Well, that's all gone, but 10 of it. But those are the introductory things that I had for you this morning. Now, following that, I had intended, but time forbids, the application of what I've said to Bible affairs. This book before me is likewise divided into five great periods. And I think that makes the study of it easy. While numbers of people have no idea on earth where to turn to begin to get ready to commence to study the Bible, they just like to turn to one place as another and think that salvation can be found on any page. And it's a kind of a jug of all sorts, as Brother Pant used to speak about various things. It has neither beginning nor end, nor anything of the kind. But the Bible is a sensible book, if you just let it be. And I outline to you those in general now. The five great periods of Bible history might be summed up as some of you boys who went to school at Fleet Ardeman with me will recall. And here they are. There's the study of the early races of mankind. And after that, there's the study of the chosen family. And then, third, there's the study of the Israelite people. And after that, they became a kingdom, and hence that period. And finally, they pass under the rule and dominion of foreign powers and become provinces, paying tribute under foreign lands. With that kind of an analysis of the entire Bible, why, you can better get at it if you're studying geography. Why, you want to take the analytical process rather than the synthetic in its study. First of all, there's the world as a whole. Next, divided into continents, two great hemispheres, Eastern and Western. Then subdivide the Eastern, Asia, Europe, Africa, Australia, and then the Western into Canada, America, Mexico, Central America, and South America. And thus you have it. And you're coming on down to where we live. Then when you get, by the way, to the United States as one of the subdivisions, why, subdivide that into 48 different parts, each called a state. And come right on down to the counties and to the city and the municipality and get right back home, by the way. Now, just so with the Bible. Look at it as a whole. A wonderful book. Indeed it is. A book that defies all opposition and has withstood the opposition throughout the years. Truly, an old anvil on which there's been in many a hammer worn to a frazzle in trying to upset it. But there is the oldest book the world has ever seen. While the prophets had spoken their words, most largely, and David had sung his song, and Solomon his proverbs, before the great pyramids were built along the historic Nile. And just so with many of the phases of it, all that you know, or will ever know, this side of the eternal world, regarding man, is found in the Bible. And since the pen of inspiration was dropped from fingers weary on the lonely Isle of Patmos, there's never been a new fact discovered, there's no new command ever been given, and there's no new promise ever announced to mankind. A wonderful volume, therefore, within itself. Well, the first part of it is the early race of mankind. That's what greets you at the start. Well, now, just when does that begin and end? Well, it begins with time unknown, away back in the distant past. And first of all begins to tell us about the creation of the earth. And may I recite to you in words of a poet about the beginning of things back there, when he said, away out there alone and above, without a thing to make it of, the world was made without a flaw, without a hammer or a saw, without a bit of wood or stone, without a bit of flesh or bone, without a board, a nail, a screw, or anything to nail it to, without a foothold or a trace of anything at all but space. The only thing the Lord could do was simply speak a word or two. And then, without apparent cause, a thing that was not now then was. And if the story told is true, the world came boldly into view and stood out there alone in space without a blade of grass or a trace of life or living thing or light, a barren world in darkest night. And that's the story regarding the creation of the earth as you begin that and continue on down the line until you come to the 11th chapter of Genesis and verse 26, and then the story changes to the chosen family. But I haven't time now to go through with all that, and it's 12 minutes past 11 o'clock according to my outfit, and here we close for the present with the promise of resuming the Bible part of it tomorrow morning at this same hour. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Brother Hardiman, and I'm sure that all of us will want to be back this evening at 7 o'clock to continue in these lectures with Brother Hardiman. I know some who would like to be here are unable to because of class schedules, but you encourage others to do so. It may be that with a little bit of encouragement, you can get some of these instructors to just bring the entire class over, and that'll be all right with us. All of you, yes. Sure. Mighty fine. Bible 362 will meet here through the week. And there are other teachers who will be making the same sort of arrangement about their class meetings, too. We're glad to have this good number to begin the program, and we invite you all to return with us during the week. As we stand now for a dismissal prayer, I'm going to ask Brother George Bailey, who is another Freed Hardiman alumnus, to please lead us in that dismissal prayer.
Our Holy Father, we pray that we may use everything at our command to better equip us for preaching the gospel and taking the good news of the cross to the world. Help us that we may keep our eyes open, that we may have receptive minds. Give us wisdom and give us vision. And help us to use all of these things to thy glory and to the salvation of men. Deepen the impressions of this hour and of the hours to follow. And may each of these services be services that we shall long remember. And may we take away the things that would help us individually in doing a better work for thee. All of these blessings and favors we ask in the name of Christ. Amen.